from the world's most venerable Chicago White Sox blog, delivering news, analysis, history, and some jokes along the way. This is the Southside Sox Podcast. Here are your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Southside Sox Podcast. This is episode 77 and the week of December 14th, 2015. I'm Josh Nelson. The winter meetings have come and gone as the dust finally settles in Nashville. Plenty of the big-name free agents signed leading up to the winter meetings, such as David Price to Boston and Zach Greinke to Arizona. Both Ben Zobrist and Jason Hayward are moving to the north side, as they would be suiting up for the Chicago Cubs in 2016 and beyond. And even Jeff Samardzija finally got his big payday, as he'll get to enjoy the pitcher-friendly confines of AT&T Park in San Francisco. Yet, we are still waiting word on where Yoenis Cespedes, Justin Upton, Alex Gordon, Johnny Cueto, and Mike Leake will eventually land. The hot stove is still burning, which gives Chicago White Sox fans hope that they can still land a big fish. It has been a pretty unspectacular offseason in the Southside, as a significant move so far were letting Giovanni Soto and Tyler Flowers go and replaced them with Alex Avila and Diarno Navarro. And of course, it wouldn't be an offseason without making a trade with the Oakland Athletics, which they picked up Brett Lowry for two pitching prospects. If you believe in what Rick Hahn says about having this team compete in 2016, then they are a long ways away from being done building this offseason. The lack of traction with their attempts this offseason has drawn some concerns on what the final product is going to be heading into 2016. To help me recap the current offseason for the White Sox and also break down what the team should do in the remaining months prior to spring training, is the managing editor of SouthsideSox.com and the co-host of the podcast, Jim Margulis. And Jim, the energy from the White Sox current offseason is pretty much matching the team's play in 2015.
Kinda. Yeah, I would say it's similar to the, in some ways, to some of the front office transition. They have made small moves that might make a difference, you know, between catcher and third base. Nothing huge, nothing that really ushers in an era change or anything like that. And, you know, they might end up paying dividends, but based on the way they've played the last 3 years, it isn't quite enough to really make fans think that anything's different. And there's still time, but yeah, none of the moves made so far have really suggested that the team is going for a more aggressive or different course than what we've seen.
Yeah, the first two moves, we didn't get a chance to get your thoughts unless you went to SouthsideSox.com and got to read your excellent columns, of course, Jim, after the White Sox let Tyler Flowers go, which then he turned around and signed a multi-year deal with the Atlanta Braves and is paired up again with A.J. Pierzynski, which is interesting.
Yeah, I lost, it wasn't really a bet with Scott Greger in the Daily Herald, but he said he thought the Braves were likely, and I thought, I don't know if he'd want to be back with AJ again, you know, backing him up after spending so much time dealing with "you're not AJ" talk over and over again. But then again, he's from Georgia. I think he's setting up shop there, you know, house there, getting a 2-year guaranteed deal instead of a, you know, 1-year deal or a minor league contract. It certainly sweetens the pot. So I misread, I guess. I thought maybe the Yankees or Rays might make a competitive offer that would maybe tip the scales in their favor, but getting 2 years from his hometown, basically, it's hard to compete with that.
And he's also paired up with Gordon Beckham.
And Emilio Bonifacio.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about Bonifacio.
Yeah. They're really committing to that protected draft pick, I think, with the guys they're reuniting.
Yeah, that's true. They will get you there.
Unless they have that big second half. Yeah, the way they've set up their roster. They might shoot themselves in the foot by just having some guys second half of the season promotions that might give them a spark and, you know, get them to 78, 80 wins and push them out of the territory.
Right. They
really had an interesting offseason.
Yeah, they have. They most definitely have. They're one of those teams that I think just has decided that, you know, to sell off the parts that they had that were valuable to build for a better future, which I know there is a certain sect of White Sox folks that wish that they made similar moves as just far as selling if you don't really think building on the team is going to help you. But, I mean, what they got back for Shelby Miller.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. If you want to watch a fun AAA team this year, watch the Gwinnett Braves. That's going to be a fun team to watch.
Yeah, the Charlotte Knights will come across them a few times.
That is true. The guy who does the play-by-play for the Gwinnett Braves is Dave Lizotte. I went to school with Dave Lizotte at UW Oshkosh. Him and I broadcasted many games together. So his dad was the executive chef for the Milwaukee Brewers. So that's how he got started with his baseball career. He used to be one of the guys that would pull out the tarp on the weekends and, you know, just doing infield work. But yeah, all the way up to AAA. Good for him.
The more you know.
The more you know. The more you know. Small world. Well, regardless, outside of Braves talk, which is pretty much the amount that I know about the Atlanta Braves at this moment, back to the White Sox, Jim. And I think the big question is, or at least the thinking surrounding why the White Sox let Tyler Flowers go. Giovanni Soto makes a lot of sense to sign with the Angels. He has an opportunity to be the starter there. But with what Rick Hahn said after signing Deonna Navarro, they're really hoping that the offense that they're going to get from Alex Avila and Deonna Navarro can help offset whatever defensive shortfalls that they have and be more productive than Tyler Flowers and Soto were in 2015. Do you believe that?
It does make sense. I think based on how, I guess, one-dimensional Flowers' value was, that most of his value came from framing, and he's one of the best, perhaps the best in the American League, and depending on whose numbers you believe, especially Bill James' handbook, which I just wrote about, called him the best defensive catcher in the American League based on the strength of his receiving. But because all his value is tied up in that, that's a little bit tricky because, you know, guys do have big one-year swings in framing, especially, you know, decline-oriented. I know I talked about Jonathan Lucroy of Milwaukee and Yadier Molina in St. Louis. Both of them lost, you know, 10 to 15 runs of framing in a year. If Flowers loses that, he becomes, you know, close to replacement level, and all of a sudden you're paying, you know, $4 million for a catcher, and, you know, he's just lost the one thing that he does well, and you know, he's got a lot of swing and miss in his game, and he, you know, his power has dropped off each year. So I could see the White Sox trying to be proactive, especially since he's a bigger catcher turning 30. Bigger catchers tend to see their framing numbers decline faster than smaller catchers. So, you know, there are some cautionary signs that maybe they think, well, we'd want to try to get out a year ahead rather than a year too late, because if they get tied to Flowers for a full year and his framing numbers just drop off. He also had knee surgery, too, in the offseason. So, there are some things that maybe think, well, if his numbers drop off, and they might, then we're stuck with a guy who doesn't really do anything well. And so we may as well try to, head that off at the pass by signing, you know, Alex Avila, who's a younger catcher than Flowers, even though he's had more health problems and might be older in terms of body. But if you give him, you know, part-time duties with Deonna Navarro, who does, you know, put the bat on the ball, he is a good offensive catcher, even though his numbers may not be, you know, that great when it comes to framing or receiving. That they might get a different shape of value that might end up being the same and maybe more useful in terms of what the White Sox need. I do think it is a little bit dangerous, and it's a curious place to start their offseason, just because they didn't need to overhaul their catcher situation. But if there's, you know, proof that if they have the inclination that maybe Flowers will tail off, and if there's maybe something that shows up and say game calling, you know, maybe their own numbers or maybe their own assessment of the way, Navarro calls a game, that maybe doesn't show up in his receiving stats so much, but maybe shows up in the way pitchers work with him. Same thing with Avila. You know, he's caught a couple Cy Young winners. Maybe they like the shape of their game calling. Maybe they think that the work behind the plate that Avila and Navarro do will maybe not come close to what Flowers did receiving wise, but might kind of shave some of the difference off just in little ways that help make up for the ground they lose in that department, and then they make up for it more so with the bat. So I can see the way the White Sox can get more value. It's dependent on Avila, though, which is kind of scary, you know, based on his concussions, his own knee surgery. He could be done. You know, maybe we've seen the best from him, and maybe that's just not going to work out. So that's the one risk that they're taking, I think. Getting a guy who they're counting on to rebound, who just might have taken too big of a beating.
Can White Sox fans trust either of these guys to take on a large workload? And by large workload, I mean more than 100 starts.
Navarro has. I don't think anything Navarro – Navarro lost his job starting because the Blue Jays signed Russell Martin. and Martin's, you know, one of the best catchers in the league. So that's no insult to Navarro. Maybe it's, you know, a sign that the Blue Jays just didn't think much of the way Navarro worked with pitchers. And that could certainly be the case, but maybe they just happen to see that even signing Martin on the open market, maybe they're still underappreciating how much catchers do behind the plate, and they thought that was the best way to add value. They certainly liked Navarro enough to not to trade him for nothing, and Navarro did play a part, and he did catch Marco Estrada well. You know, Estrada's turnaround and the way that shaped the rotation was tied to Navarro. There were stories about how Navarro helped him, just work with what he had and really take advantage of the spin rate on his fastball and everything like that. So there are signs that Navarro can catch more than 100 games and do pretty well. His job happened to be usurped by maybe the American League's best catcher, or one of them certainly, and that's no insult to him. But I guess that would be the worst case scenario is if Vila doesn't show up, then Navarro would have to take on the bulk of the duties, and then maybe third catcher goes to Rob Brantley or Kevin Smith, and that's a little dicey. And I think that's Avila is more likely than Soto to miss those games. Soto was his own risk, and Soto stayed healthy. So I guess that's the they're placing a lot of hope, I think, on Herb Schneider, which really isn't the worst thing to do. But one foul tip could change things, and that's really out of Herm's control. So there is some risk, but I think Navarro is up to the task. And just in terms of getting those games, whether or not he's capable of holding up and performing all the way through is a different matter. But I think in terms of getting the games caught, I think those guys will be able to deliver 162 games.
All right, and let's move over to the biggest move the White Sox have made so far, and that's Brett Lawrie. Best thing about him, Jim, is that he is much, much better than Mike Olt or Matt Davidson.
Yeah, you were really concerned about Mike Olt.
I was very concerned that Mike Olt was going to be seriously taken as one of the starters going to 2016. Just after we heard the rumors that the Angels and David Freese had really good discussions, and it looked like, and it still may happen, where David Freese re-signs with the Angels. Then it was like, uh-oh. Because if the White Sox aren't going to get Todd Frazier, and if they're really not interested in trying to pick up Martin Prado, or the Marlins are just not interested in moving Prado because maybe they're thinking they're going to compete in 2016 after spending the money to hire Don Mattingly to be their manager, then who do you get? Third base to be better than Mike Olt. And they went out and they got him. His name is Brett Lawrie. He can either play second or third base. He's going to be projected as probably a 1.5 to 2 win player. 2 wins probably going to be his ceiling, which is a big boost for the White Sox, whether he is playing third or second base, Jim. However, if this is the big move of the offseason for the White Sox, how disappointing will that be?
Oh, it'd be incredibly disappointing that the biggest move only took Zach Irwin and JB Wendelken. So, it can't be the biggest move just because they're basically buying Lawrie low. There are some, we've written about it and talked about it, but there are some, signs in his game that are worrisome. The jump in strikeouts, the jump in swing and misses. His defensive numbers also went backwards into negative territory, although I'm thinking that might be partially attributable to going from turf in Rogers Center to grass for the first time. He'd play his turf his entire career in the home park, and maybe something was off with his positioning. Maybe he's not used to having to play on grass and having to adjust himself and play certain guys the way he did in Toronto. So maybe there's a 1 year adjustment period for the turf. And he'll be back because he has the physical tools still. He's still pretty fast. He's got the range and the arm strength. So it seems like he should have the playmaking ability to at least be average there and not below average like the numbers say he was last year. But otherwise, there are signs that, his bat is, maybe he's like Gordon Beckham. His best days were in his first couple of years, and that's been a steady slide down. But given what they paid for him and they gave Wendelken, who's a he's a bullpen possibility, but he doesn't profile as a high leverage guy. And then Zach Irwin, who had a very nice year just being drafted, but he's a pitchability lefty, and the White Sox tend to find those guys and work with those guys well. They could easily replace him in next year's draft, with a similar guy of who doesn't have the highest ceiling, but can get a few pitches over the plate. They just, really didn't use any of the resources, whether trading resources or, or financial. So it would seem odd that that would be the biggest move or even come close to it, because they still have a lot of spending they can do and still have a lot of prospects they can trade.
The A's think Wendelken could be part of their bullpen in 2016. That's how high they're on Wendelken.
It could be. It just doesn't seem like he doesn't have the right. The velocity. And plus the A's bullpen was a mess. So maybe that's like saying he could be in the 2014 White Sox bullpen.
Yeah, that's true.
So, that's true. It might be relative, but he doesn't seem like a high leverage guy. And the White Sox have successfully, recycled some guys for that kind of spot, whether it's Javi Guerra or, Daniel Webb. And now they have Tommy Canley that they traded for from Colorado, who's kind of that high octane arm, gets a lot of grounders, might not know where it's going. They'll have that that project for Don Cooper for the front end of the bullpen. So they can get rid of a guy like Wendelken and be fine. So, I think you might see him in Oakland, but I don't think he's somebody who the Sox will regret missing just because they have a few similar arms who they can kind of cycle through and figure out who might be the best fit.
Other teams in Major League Baseball, such as the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Chicago Cubs, Jim, have been super aggressive this offseason. If you have been living under a rock, I'm sure you have heard what both the Diamondbacks and the Cubs have done. The Diamondbacks seriously adding to their starting rotation and signing Zach Greinke, a great piece by Ken Rosenthal that he posted on Sunday, and how in just a matter of 6 hours they were able to sneak in and sign Greinke away from the San Francisco Giants and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And of course, sacrificing quite a bit. I don't know why, but they want to just trade all their first round picks to the Atlanta Braves. So I'm curious to see what move they're going to make after June, or even next offseason when the Diamondbacks trade their 2016 first-round pick to the Atlanta Braves. But those moves happen in another league. And, of course, what the Cubs do impacts White Sox fans from a fan standpoint, especially if you live in the city of Chicago, because it's impossible to get away from how happy Cubs fans are today that their team, after rebuilding, youth movement, have all this cash, and they are going and they are spending on some of the best players in the game of baseball, and Ben Zobrist and in Jason Hayward. But in the American League Central, as you pointed out in one of your columns, Jim, it's been quiet. Outside of what the Tigers did, signing Jordan Zimmermann to a 5-year, $100 million plus dollar contract. Other teams in the AL Central haven't made very big additions. Minnesota signed Bianjo Park to a 4-year, $12 million deal, but I don't consider that to be a big addition. Let's say it was reversed. Let's say it was the Tigers who went out super aggressive and they signed Jason Hayward instead of the Cubs. Do you think having an interdivisional rival making a big splash like that would impact the way that the White Sox front office is currently handling this offseason, and would that force them to make a big splash of their own?
I think it could. Maybe not move for move. Maybe it's not they sign a guy and we have to, but it does change the projections, and the White Sox do operate off of projections. It would be more along the lines of that. How many wins do they think they added? How many runs did they add offensively? How does that change the complexion of the lineup? How it matches against their pitching, that sort of thing. And I think that the Tigers being as active as they are is, it does change the division in the sense that the White Sox are trying to gain as many wins as the Tigers, basically starting from the same spot, and the Tigers have gone about in a slightly different way. They've been a little more, they sold David Price, so that kind of helped. The White Sox really don't have that kind of expiring contract that they can deal the way that the Tigers dealt Price and got Daniel Norris back. And now they've invested a lot in this offseason. Now, Al Avila has been pretty active in trying to reshape the team in his image after they fired Dombrowski. And the White Sox have been playing it more slowly, and given the way the market has unfolded slowly for position players, that might not be the worst call in the world, especially at some positions. Outfield is just starting to get moving, infield's been pretty quiet. It's been odd that, you know, the White Sox let or they chose not to pick up Alexi Ramirez's option. I haven't heard anything about Ramirez in terms of you know, potential suitors. I've heard he's going to Cuba as part of that you know, ambassador mission, but I haven't heard anything in terms of rumors, in terms of teams trading for him. So, you know, maybe he comes back on a cheaper deal, you know, based on the way these things have gone before. But yeah, there have been some positions where just very little has happened, and maybe that'll be to the White Sox benefit as the market plays out. Maybe they're maybe the demand for them and the positions they need or can upgrade is different from the rest of the market. They certainly picked up Laurie for less than I thought they would get, just because there really aren't that many third basemen, but I guess there aren't that many teams looking for third basemen, and it might be the same in other positions like shortstop or second base seems to be a little bit deeper, and also teams looking to reshape that a little bit more. But yeah, on the left side of the infield, and maybe even the outfield spot, maybe one of those outfielders will shake loose to them. But yeah, the White Sox really haven't looked terrible for you know, letting it play out more slowly, but the Tigers have seemed to fill their needs based on their timetable pretty well.
You made a comment that the White Sox work off projections. Do you think that the signing of Zimmerman is a great deal of impact on how the White Sox are looking offensively and trying to improve the team? I know that was a big focal point as far as upgrading a catcher, that Rick Hahn made it known that he wasn't very happy with the offense last year and he's looking to upgrade it, which I was just curious because catcher's not very high on the list where I would be improving the offense from in the beginning. But is with the Tigers signing Zimmerman, do you think that really moves the needle a whole lot, not only for the White Sox, but for the other teams in the AL Central?
I think it, you know, I don't know if it does in terms of, you know, I guess Zimmerman's got his own question marks going from the National League to the American League. He did lose some velocity. His, you know, his strikeout rate took a bit of a hit. Not compared to historically, but, you know, 1 year drop. There were some signs that maybe, you know, he's also had Tommy John surgery. You know, you mentioned that he was the first Tommy John surgery recipient to receive a $100 million deal. And those guys seem to have a shelf life in terms of how long those surgeries hold up. So there are some signs that maybe, you know, he's not going to be as dominant as he was in his peak in Washington. And maybe the Tigers will have spent a little inefficiently there. I think it does cause the rest of the division to perk up a little bit and think, okay, what else are they trying to do? This is definitely a win now move. And they're looking to be active and looking to be part of it. But I don't know if that single move changes the equation so much in terms of how many wins they added, because they might look at it and see like, oh, well, we looked at Zimmerman ourselves and we thought we were scared of this, or we thought that, you know, this might hurt him in this league, or this might hurt him against, you know, these hitters or whatever. And so that might, you know, based on the scouting reports from one free agent and based on teams' internal assessments of one free agent, you know, teams might respond to that differently, but I do think it sends a message in terms of what the Tigers intend to do with the rest of their offseason. And so, and based on what they spend on Zimmerman, what they can spend elsewhere. And so teams might have to respond to that more than responding to any single one player.
Yeah, that I bring that point up because you look at the National League West, teams are super competitive and very aggressive right now on how they're handling the offseason, with the Diamondbacks getting Greinke and Miller, as pointed out, the Giants going back and countering the Greinke signing to sign Jeff Samardzija, and the Dodgers trying to make something happen as far as whether to boost the bullpen. I know the Dodgers are not done yet, and they're going to probably add even more pitching. But it's just funny to look at all the craziness that's going in the National League West, and then you look how quiet it is in the National League East and how quiet it is in the American League Central. And I just wonder if the White Sox, if their needle is going to move where they go from patiently waiting to see how the market is turning out, which I think is what the current mood is at now, to being super aggressive and going out and getting someone now. It would be a move similar to what the Diamondbacks make or what's going on in the National League West, having the Tigers or the Royals radically changing the way that their lineup or their rotations look like. Then I could see the White Sox being hyper-aggressive. But if nobody else in the AL Central at this moment is looking to make any bigger additions, then I could see where the White Sox want to patiently wait, because at this moment, going off on projections, the Royals are going to be losing some players. They may not be as good as last year. Adding Zimmerman most definitely helps the Tigers, but there's still a lot of question marks. The Indians, good Lord, that outfield has been decimated.
Well, Michael Brantley, it's the time frame on him has been weird.
It is. June Gammons to August now.
Yeah, like, Peter Gammons gave an August return date, and the Indians kind of refuted that, but not entirely convincingly. It's
right.
I would be concerned if I were a Cleveland blogger.
Right. And then the Twins, which the Twins did make an addition, but it's not earth-shattering. I just wonder if it was a different universe and the Tigers were that team that was just like the Cubs, where they got like Zobrist and Hayward, how different would the White Sox offseason would be? And I didn't know if I was off base, in which, yeah, the White Sox would be more aggressive if the Tigers were more aggressive. I'm just looking at the other divisions and how some divisions are really crazy right now, and there's some divisions that are just absolutely quiet.
It could be if they're competing for the same player, like we saw in the NL West with Greinke. You know, Dodgers and Giants going for Greinke. Diamondbacks come in. Then the Giants go fall back to Plan B, and then the Dodgers have to find their own Plan B. It could be that kind of situation. But so far, Zimmerman, White Sox weren't going to be on somebody like him. So we did see what the catcher market moved very quickly. All these guys moving for the same price. And so the White Sox seemed to jump in there when they saw guys coming off the board faster than they anticipated. So I do think the way, they would be really well served by picking up an outfielder, and those guys are just starting to move, and seems like they're at least one infielder short. They could go with Sanchez at second. They could go Saladino at short, or they could go with Lurie at third. But it seems like they would need at least one major infield addition to mitigate the risk of starting somebody like Saladino at short or Sanchez at second, if they never come around.
And you know what? Fans are wondering that as well, which means we are going to move over to P.O. Sox, as we have some great questions this week regarding the rest of the offseason. So Jim and I are going to take a quick break. When we come back, it's P.O. Sox.
You've stuffed our mailbox all week with questions from your tweets and Facebook posts. Now to cure your curiosity on the White Sox, here is P.O. Sox.
Thanks, Rob. And yes, this is our favorite part of the show, where you, the fans and listeners, get to ask the questions. It's P.O. Sox, where you submitted your questions to us via Twitter by tweeting them to us at Southside Sox, posting them on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Southside Sox, or you also texted your questions to us at 312-870-0224. Keep in mind, standard text message rates do apply. And of course, answering your questions on this edition of the P.O. Sox is the managing editor of SouthsideSox.com, Jim Margulis. And Jim, let's dive right in. We have four excellent questions. And the first question via Twitter comes from Bob Belke, and Bob is asking you, Jim, I would have thought Avisail Garcia would be gone by now. Does he have any value?
He does have value, but not, I don't think, as a standalone trade asset. I think it would be similar to the Brett Lurie trade in terms of you're buying a guy at the lower part of his value, or maybe whether they're buying lower, whether they're buying what he is going to be. There are questions about that when you look at basically Garcia's season, his defensive numbers, his offensive numbers, his plate discipline, the way his batted balls tend to shake out, the way he hits a lot of grounders, which doesn't take advantage of his natural strength. He doesn't pull the ball in the air very well, which limits his home run potential. There's just a lot of worrisome signs, and given that he's still young, 24, going on 25, there is possibility that he can work with that hit. He does have a decent hit tool. He does have the ability to leg out infield singles. He does have the ability to, support a high batting average on balls in play if he could get some of the worrisome kinks out of his game. But, there's a possibility that could never come along. And so I don't see another team trading for Avi in terms of a solution. I think he would be best traded as somebody as like kind of a I don't know if you'd call him a pot sweetener so much, because he might not, he might not say, oh, now that's a trade I want to make. But in terms of if a team has a depth problem in a corner outfield spot, if they need a starter for, say, half a season or maybe a couple months while a guy's coming back from injury, platoon partner, that kind of thing. And they're not looking to – they don't need production from that corner, but they might, you know, want to bank on a little bit of upside or explore that kind of upside. And I could see him being added and being a worthwhile piece to an addition. But I think if you tried trading him as a standalone in a standalone deal, I think you would get a similar package of, you know, questionable prospects at best, just because if teams are looking to get production from him right away, it'll never show up. And I think the White Sox, you know, Rick Hahn talking about how he didn't maintain his weight during the season and how he kind of got that got away from during the season. That's kind of, I guess, a little bit honest, a little bit too honest for a team that's hoping to deal him. So I think maybe they've explored dealing him and are, yeah, you know, I don't know if they want to start him or they're intent on starting him or resigned to starting him. But it does seem like they are aware that his trade value is not particularly high as somebody who can be moved as the headliner in a deal. I think it would be more as a secondary or tertiary piece in a deal that a team might just want to kind of kick the tires, explore what he might be able to do, but not be tied to him for years as a solution to a position for a team that's trying to climb.
Let's go to the next question. Bob, thank you so much for your question. Kevin Shannon via Twitter is asking you, Jim, do you agree that the White Sox probably won't sign a mid-tier free agent considering their desire to keep the comp pick they got from Jeff Samardzija? Justin Upton, Yoenis Cespedes, or trade, if anything, that the White Sox could possibly do the rest of the offseason? And Jim, right now, where the White Sox stand as far as the draft picks, they do have three in the top 50 as they stand going into next year's draft, and that could be even three in the top 45.
I think ideally they would like to only use the compensation pick on somebody who, you know, like you mentioned, the Justin Upton, Yoenis Cespedes, somebody who is really a high profile target. However, you know, when we talked about before, like with the shortstops and Alex Ramirez, one guy who I haven't seen really anything on is Ian Desmond. He looked like he might have been the best shortstop in the class. He had a down year last year, but there were signs of a rebound. You know, there were some injuries you could point to, and, you know, somebody who could be a high impact bat at shortstop and a decent glove. And the last rumors I've seen have talked about moving him to the outfield. He does make a lot of errors at short, but he does have the range. It's kind of like Jose Valentin back in, you know, around the turn of the century. White Sox fans didn't like his errors, and Jerry Manuel certainly didn't like his errors. But when you looked at his metrics and looked at the plays he made some plays that were, you know, above average shortstops. You couldn't make easily. So, you know, Desmond might be a similar case where he does make errors and they pile up, but the bat might offset it. And, you know, if the White Sox have a hole at shortstop or, you know, second base, you know, depending on how their infield shakes out, and they need an infielder who does have upside, you know, like they look for offensive upside from catcher, Desmond could be an interesting guy to look at a deal that's palatable for an open market price. And that's, I think, the kind of free agent that they might not have intended to use a draft pick on, but if the market shakes out and the way, you know, a guy like Desmond is looking right now, if teams are looking to shift him to the outfield, which would be kind of a bad use of his value, you know, a White Sox might make more sense for him, even if it's on a deal that might, and if they're looking to change him to maybe second or the outfield later date and make room for Tim Anderson, maybe they can do that. That's the one hang up, I guess, on signing Desmond would be that it would maybe complicate Tim Anderson's near future. But if the way the shortstop market is and the way teams are kind of already advocating a defensive shift for him, you know, maybe 1 year at shortstop for Desmond would be sensible. You know, it's hard to tell at this point, but there are some positions that really haven't moved and you really can't get an idea of, you know, what might be a good buy. Howie Kendrick is another one, second base. There really hasn't been a lot of activity around him, but, you know, he could be somebody who adds a couple wins at second base for a deal that was less than originally thought. So there are some mid-tier free agents who might not be the most exciting use of a draft pick, but might end up adding a lot of value if they just don't really have a lot of movement at those positions. Seeing as Drubal Cabrera come off and Desmond's still around, he's kind of popped up in my mind as somebody who might be more available than we thought at a better price than we thought.
I just think this is those two guys that you mentioned are good examples on how being attached to a qualifying offer and a draft pick really, really hurts your value out in the open market and really drives down the price.
And when you see teams like the Orioles, you know, they signed Nelson Cruz on under similar circumstances, you know, late winter signing, gave up a draft pick, but Cruz certainly made up for that with the way he played, you know, giving away more than they thought. You know, it's not the worst use of a draft pick. And so I'm not too married to the idea of, you know, having three picks in the top 50, top 45. Having even, you know, maybe if they give up their compensation pick, you know, for an Upton Cespedes great outfielder and then lose the second rounder for somebody like Desmond on a pretty good deal otherwise, I wouldn't be opposed to that necessarily. But it would certainly be nice to have one of those picks at least by, say, February, just to see in case there's somebody who has been killed by that attached draft pick and maybe the White Sox can pick him up for the push in 2016. That's where I think a case where, you know, maybe losing the second rounder isn't that bad of a deal. I would try not to, just because they did give up, you know, two picks last year and then they traded Zach Irwin too. So they really, you know, Carson Fulmer, and then you're going to the fifth round after that. So it would be nice to be able to restock the farm, but based on how they're trying to win now, I would keep in mind somebody like Desmond or Kendrick or somebody who just really isn't drawing a lot of excitement on the open market, but could be had at a decent price by the end of the winter if just the way their markets have materialized hasn't worked out the way we thought they might have at the start of the offseason.
You know, it's funny about the draft right now because we're talking December, and if you read SouthsideSox.com, I had an opportunity to chat with Nick Hostetler, who's the White Sox new director of amateur scouting.
Yeah, that was great.
When you look at the St. Louis Cardinals right now, having four picks in the top 50, if things were to stand as they are today, man, it's like the rich keep getting richer as far as prospect-wise. Like, Cubs fans, you should be super ecstatic, super happy, and getting, like, Jason Hayward. John Lackey, for me, does not move the needle whatsoever. I think he could be really beneficial as far as when the playoffs come around, just make sure that he's healthy when the playoffs come around because he is 37 years old. But it's going to be funny in 5 years if Cubs fans are still complaining that, gosh, the Cardinals, man, they're always good. And it's going to be like, well, you gave them two draft picks back in 2016 as far as the draft. So you had no one else to blame, but maybe you, but I'm sure at that point they're going to be, you know, swimming in the riches of having Jason Hayward roaming in the outfield, so they shouldn't feel too bad. But I think White Sox fans, however, Jim, if that move this offseason was to use that comp pick from Jeff Samardzija to sign someone like Ian Desmond and not signing somebody like Justin Upton, of course Cespedes doesn't have a qualifying offer attached to him, so he wouldn't lose a draft pick. And that was it. And they gave up their comp pick for Samardzija to sign for Desmond. I could see where White Sox fans would be quite angry.
Yeah, that would be a little disappointing.
Yeah. But I do agree with you, though. If they were to sign Upton and then February came around and you can get Desmond on a one-year, $8 million deal and have him play shortstop in 2016, giving you, you know, buying you a year waiting for Tim Anderson, then yeah, Tim, you know, Ian Desmond is totally worth that second round pick as far as the quality shortstop that he can be. It's just for Ian Desmond, Jim, it's just heartbreaking because he turned down that mega deal. What was it? It was more than $100 million, right?
I'm looking it up right now because
it's gonna bug me. But he turned down a huge deal with the Nationals to stay as their shortstop because he thought he was worth more than that.
Yeah, man. 7 years, $107
million. Oh, man.
Yeah.
There's just, I don't see him ever getting a deal like that again.
It'll be tough.
Then again, Johnny Cueto right now is probably kicking himself in the butt for not signing that $120 million deal with the Diamondbacks.
Yeah, I'm looking that up right now. It looks like it might have been affected by Elvis Andrus signing a 8-year, $120 million deal, and Andrus is lucky to sign that because his value is taking a hit.
He Yeah, if he declined that, I can guarantee you he's not making that.
So, yeah.
Kevin, great question. Loved it. Thank you so much for submitting the question. Let's go to Facebook. And posting onto our Facebook page is Dane Kripe. And Dane's asking you, Jim, I'm having a hard time finding a way for the Chicago White Sox to match up with the Cincinnati Reds for Todd Frazier, even though they are interested. They want prime position prospects, not our pitchers. Do you think something might be possible, like attaching Jay Bruce to the deal, a negative trade asset yet possibly useful to the White Sox, and make it a more achievable trade? Maybe Micah Johnson, Trace Thompson, and one of the top five prospects as far as pitchers or something? Dane, thank you so much for your question. And yes, we did learn through the winter meetings that the White Sox were trying to get Todd Frazier. The Reds asked for Tim Anderson, and then that's where talks ended. If the Reds are still desperate, and they are desperate, Jim, to try to loosen up some cash, they would love for somebody to take Brandon Phillips off their hands. If the White Sox circled back to try to make a move for Todd Frazier, what would you be willing to give up?
It doesn't seem – I guess, you know, I could see maybe a three-team deal making sense, you know, based on the needs. The Reds are weird. You know, they're hard to pin down because they seem like they need to rebuild. They kind of admit it at times, but they also have big contracts, like Joey Votto's huge deal and, you know, Jay Bruce's, and, you know, Phillips is making a lot of money. But they aren't really – you don't hear a lot of activity. Even Frazier, they're driving – it sounds like they're driving a really hard bargain for – teams need a third baseman, and you know, there isn't as much you know, buzz around Frazier as you might expect from somebody who, you know, from a team that needs a deal and you know, has something to trade. Like, you know, we look at the Braves and Shelby Miller. You heard about, a lot about Shelby Miller before the Diamondbacks closed the deal. You heard him going to a few different teams. Frazier, it seems like there should be more activity and there isn't, but the Reds are always kind of weird about where they are in trying to rebuild. I think their ownership is similar to the White Sox in terms of they believe that they can't commit to a full-on rebuilding. So they, you know, the way they market themselves and the way they, you know, the way they position themselves and the way they position trades, where they are giving up a little bit of present value to shift the future, they really are averse to phrasing as a rebuild. So I don't see them being a team that would kind of sink Frazier's independent trade value with somebody like Bruce, because then they would be saying, like, we just need to get rid of money and we can't get exciting players back, or we're willing to not get exciting players back. I think they would need somebody who could contribute right away or be close to major league ready. So I don't see them using Frazier as a vehicle to move a contract like Jay Bruce's. You know, maybe I'm wrong in that case, but based on the way they've kind of gone about, you know, their future or assessing their present and building towards the future slowly and rather deliberately, I think they're going to try to get Frazier for as much as they can independently. When it comes to the White Sox, you know, I guess Frazier, you know, Anderson would be a no-go. Thompson's kind of a weird one. Trace Thompson's, you know, you've heard his name come up a bunch over the course of the winter, and he's a tricky guy to evaluate because he is the White Sox best defensive outfielder, and he does have upside that's been hinted about, and, you know, his tools suggest he might be able to realize. But his minor league track record has been so sketchy that maybe his audition is the best he'll ever play in terms of, you know, consistent dynamic at bats. And he just might be somebody who's more of a fourth outfielder than he was always supposed to be. But he's a guy who's tricky to trade just because he does represent the White Sox best internal chance at upgrading the outfield. And, I've seen his name come up in win now, type trades, and he would be somebody who would be interesting to trade for Frazier and as a young position player. I just wonder if that, you know, that hurts the White Sox more than helps them, because maybe they're buying Frazier high and maybe they're selling Thompson at a little bit low for that kind of deal. That's the one player who I think might be hard to deal. Otherwise, I think the other guys, like maybe Montas, Fulmer is somebody who, you know, way teams evaluate him as maybe a bullpen arm. Maybe the White Sox are wrong about that, and he is more of a bullpen arm. If those guys are maybe best suited as relievers, then I think independently one of those guys could be dealt for him. I wouldn't want to package both of them, but maybe one could lead a deal in a smaller piece. But Thompson, I think, would be the most appealing position player of the deal. I just don't know how much that hurts him, because he's a tricky guy to evaluate. If he looks like he did last year, or even comes close to looking like he did last year, that's a pretty valuable player. And when the White Sox don't have in ready supply, they're thin in the outfield. So that's the one guy I could see being moved who ultimately ends up hurting the White Sox' ability to win now, just because he does have more present-day value than maybe we even think.
If nobody gets hurt, opening day is Trace Thompson, the center fielder, and Adam Eaton's in left field.
Could be. I think depending on the handedness of the starter, if there's a platoon situation going on, especially if there's a lefty, if LaRoche is, if LaRoche is still around, he's on the bench, Melky Cabrera's DHing. I could see Trace playing center and Eaton playing left. Eaton sounded up to it, or open to it, rather. So, that wouldn't be bad. I think that would certainly be a better defensive outfield than Eaton in center and Trace in the corner, even though Trace can play corner pretty well.
Yeah, and just, I don't know about that. Like, not about Trace Thompson's ability.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious on why they're floating that idea right now. That Thompson could be the White Sox starting center fielder in 2016.
I mean, it's, based on the way Eaton's numbers were, I think it's kind of a reasonable assessment of getting the most out of, if Thompson's bat is questionable or maybe kind of iffy, if he's an above-average center fielder, that makes up for his bat. And certainly you don't have to worry about so much about getting premium offensive production. And if it improves Eaton numbers, maybe that gets the most value from him. It also, boosts Thompson's value. Or like if the White Sox...
It does. I think that's the big part. Yeah.
So, I mean, it doesn't hurt to float that on a number of levels. It makes sense for the White Sox. It makes sense for the White Sox moving them. So it doesn't hurt to muse about that openly.
Yeah, just... I was very curious on why they were bringing that up now. I could totally see that being a point of discussion in late February after you get, the players and you sent out your invites to spring training and being like, yeah, this is going to be a focal point. Adam, we'd like you to play some left field during spring training because if it makes a team better, we may have Trace Thompson as the starting center fielder and then move you to left.
I think it's a question the beat writers are asking just because Thompson's name does come up in trade rumors, and it is a question about how they're going to use him. And I think it's also a question that the White Sox like answering. So it's probably the best of both worlds.
Yeah, very true. All right, let's go to – gosh, this is a tearing experience. The final question of the Season 2 of the Southside Sox podcast in P.O. Sox, and it comes from Logan Hard.
Let's end it on an angry note.
Yes, of course. Logan is asking you, Jim, there's no way Robin Ventura can run a country club spring training again, right? No kids with GoPros. He has to be tougher. Logan, thank you for your question / comment. And, Jim, going into spring training, how should Robin Ventura handle this team? And will he handle that team in that manner?
Well, to clarify for people who know the kids with GoPro thing, if you didn't see it on the White Sox, Adam LaRoche's kid, Drake, he's been a regular part of LaRoche's spring trainings where he's gone. And, on their social media channels, Instagram and Twitter and such and Facebook, LaRoche, the younger LaRoche, ran around with the White Sox with a camera and provided some footage and stuff. And I did see that come up as a point of contention, especially as LaRoche played worse and worse, that, seeing too much of his kid, and I felt bad for his kid. But I do wonder, based on the way LaRoche has played, the trade rumor, we didn't talk about that. The White Sox tried moving LaRoche to Pittsburgh and throwing in $8 million of his $13 million owed to him for the rest of his contract. That's kind of indicative of what they... I think that's somewhat indicative of what the White Sox think that LaRoche has to offer. And I think if you didn't see the same thing with LaRoche's kid running around and being a focal point of the White Sox offseason promos or how they advertise the team on Facebook and such, you could see the comments getting pretty biting. And I think that might be kind of counterproductive or or not beneficial to anybody putting kids in the crosshairs just because they happen to be there running around. I don't see it being. I don't. Yeah, I did hear that before White Sox fans complaining about LaRoche's kid being too involved, but that happened in Washington too. When LaRoche gave the Nationals a couple good years. His kid being there and he played well for them. The Nationals played well. They made the playoffs under an equally or more questionable manager and Matt Williams. So I don't think I wouldn't focus on that too much, but I am curious to see whether the White Sox try to downplay everything LaRoche related in the spring based on how little goodwill his name has. Otherwise, I just don't see Ventura changing much. I don't know if anything in spring training that he could do will make a difference. When he came in from, when he came in to replace Ozzie in 2012, he did run a more hands-on spring training, and it did seem to make a difference. And then they tailed off at the end of the year, and then they've had three losing seasons since. Has he changed the way he's run his spring trainings when he was the supposed new sheriff? I don't think he has necessarily. It hasn't, word hasn't been that it's been any easier or any more, any less stringent. So he might not have changed. He might have been the guy that was lauded as the new sheriff in 2012, and it just the team has not played well. The talent hasn't been there, and it hasn't been anything related to Ventura. It would just spring training is so hard to project any kind of, momentum or value on, given the weird environments, the players that, who need to be evaluated, the spring training heroes that tend to disappoint in April. There are just so many weird things about spring training that I really wouldn't overreact to anything going on in spring training. This is one of the cases that we talked about, that bringing Ventura back really does make it harder for the White Sox just to really market themselves, position themselves as anything new or exciting until the games start counting. anything that Ventura does or doesn't do, or anything that's the byproduct of his natural attitude is going to be the source of irritation. And White Sox fans aren't wrong for being irritated based on the way they've played and based on the way the White Sox did stagnate a little bit in terms of decision making and strategy and things that are directly related to the manager's chair. So the White Sox did acknowledge some of that, and it does seem like the way they acknowledged it, in the firing of Mark Parent, did give them leeway or give them the reason to change the manager entirely, and they didn't do that. So they're stuck with this kind of criticism, and some of it's warranted, some of it isn't. I would hope that White Sox fans aren't going to rip on a teenager who has nothing to do with anything. I'm hoping that it doesn't extend to that, but it does get tricky to really market the White Sox as anything new or exciting with Ventura still there. And this is the kind of stuff that's going to be reflective of that. I do think that it's worth monitoring and worth watching to see how many at-bats LaRoche gets, what kind of role he's expected to get, because I think based on the amount of cash they're willing to throw in, that I think he's going to be getting a diminished role, whether it's platoon DH, whether it's a bench bat. I guess it depends on, one, whether the White Sox do get the outfielder, like an Upton or a Cespedes, who moves Melky into a rotating between left field and DH, and then that would certainly move LaRoche to the bench. And, whether Avi Garcia is still around in some capacity, it's kind of weird, but if LaRoche is still getting regular bats in spring training and getting the bats of a starter, I think that would be a little bit tricky and counterproductive. That's why I think that the White Sox still have to make, going back to one of the first things we talked about, they still need to make a big addition just to kind of marginalize the players who were the most hurtful, whether it's an infielder, or whether it's DH, whether it's the corner outfield spot. Adding a corner outfielder would address two of those positions, the corner outfield spot and DH. So that really seems to be the move they need to make that would make things a lot easier to talk about this team for 2016. Somebody who does represent a sea change of sorts, somebody who is visibly, visually, aesthetically more exciting, like an Upton or Cespedes. So I really hope the White Sox get in on that, or make, not necessarily, confining them to free agent signing, but make a trade of somebody of equal excitement, because it's going to be hard pressed for them to generate the kind of excitement elsewhere, given that they have some obligations that they need to see through to the end, or to the end they can, you know, whether it's May and they pay him off the rest of the way and, you know, pay his exit. But, you know, they do have some things to endure, and they do have some things that they, you know, the fates that they've chosen, bringing Ventura back. And it does seem like they need one big move to kind of represent a push towards 2016 that marginal moves like Navarro and Avila and Laurie aren't going to do themselves. So I still think there's one huge move for them to make.
I agree. I don't know if that's free agency or by trade, but I'm also hopeful, Jim, that there's one more big move. Here's a question that I have for you, because I find myself getting into this, let's call a debate on Twitter. If the White Sox were to sign a Justin Upton or a Yoenis Céspedes, as someone that has blogged about the White Sox for the last 10 years, and you have seen the waves of fans paying attention to the team, do you think that move that would make a tremendous difference on how many fans either attend games or pay attention to the White Sox?
I would say it won't make an immediate change in how many fans attend games, but I do think it'll change the way people talk about the team. People will be wanting to see, whether it's watching games, occasionally checking in, watching, you know, individual bats, you know, reading about the game the next day on SouthsideSox.com and otherwise. I do think there will be more interest in seeing how these big names respond. So it wouldn't put butts in the seats right away. It's not going to put butts in the seats in a cold April after three losing seasons. But it will indicate that the White Sox are still looking at 2016. I think that's the one danger in terms of if they don't make a big move, is making a push for 2015 made no sense if somebody like Adam LaRoche could so easily undermine it with a bad year. That's, I think, the one thing that they couldn't really, that would be really hard to sell afterwards, is that, you know, we still have to, you know, go through our financial obligations. If there was a risk that a two-year contract to Adam LaRoche could prevent them from making the big move in 2016 for one of the big outfielders that they knew they might have needed, I think that's where it got stupid. Not so much Samardzija for 1 year, because, you know, they lost Marcus Semien, big deal.
Was awesome. July, yeah. Samardzija was a lot of fun to watch.
You could see, there were moments where you could see what the White Sox had in mind, and it just didn't work out. But Marcus Semien, nice player. I liked him a lot. But, you know, they can get an infielder like that. You know, they can, you know, whether it's Brett Laurie getting back from Oakland, maybe he bounces back and provides the same value that Semien provides. You know, it could be at the end, you know, at the end of 2 years, it could be almost a wash. When you have a guy like LaRoche on a 2 year deal, who's like, oh, maybe he'll get a good DH year out of him and trade him or whatever. And if he undermines the White Sox ability to spend or really commit to a cornerstone type signing, then that's where it went wrong. And I would like to see LaRoche marginalized by a big move of some kind.
I think we all do. They tried to dump him to the Pirates, but the Pirates just didn't want to pay $5 million for him. That's how bad it is right now.
Yeah, and, you know, based on the other corner bets there, yeah, they had Pedro Alvarez, and they non-tendered him, so they basically know what a first baseman is worth, you know, left-handed hitting first baseman.
Yeah, I didn't want to spend 5 minutes talking about it. Pedro Alvarez being available in the market has significantly diminished the ability for the White Sox to move Adam LaRoche.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Oh, man. Great stuff. Great stuff. No, I agree with you. I mean, even if the White Sox did sign Justin Upton and Yoenis Céspedes, Chicago is just in a weird place right now as a city. I mean, if you're not living in the city anymore and you live on the outside, it's weird. You can watch the news and you see the protest, and living in the city, it's in a difficult spot right now as far as state. And I don't know if that the social and the economic reasons will also impact if it's 45 degrees on a Tuesday night at US Cellular Field and the White Sox are facing the Indians and only 5,000 people show up. I think the number that does need to move for the White Sox is television ratings. They just cannot be that low last year, under one. And they were last out of all teams in TV ratings. They had better success getting people at the ballpark than they did having people watch TV. Now, unfortunately, those numbers do not capture people such as yourself, Jim, who are, you know, watching on MLB.TV, for example. Those are not incorporated to the TV ratings, and unfortunately, MLB Advanced Media does not release those numbers out to the public. But for the people that have cable in the Chicagoland area, just the White Sox had a better chance of getting you to the stadium in 2015 than having you watch on TV, and that's a problem. Because I know people have work the next day. They have kids. You know, it's very difficult to have fans go from Monday through Thursday. You need people like me, who are in their late 20s and early 30s, who live in the city of Chicago, to hop on the Red Line and go catch a baseball game for very cheap. Those are the fans that you need. And Chicago does have those fans.
How many games did you go to?
I went to 21, Jim.
Nice.
And by the way, the ticket guy who called me and he asked me to renew my season ticket plan knew that.
Nice.
He was like, "Are you sure, Mr. Nelson? You sure you only want to buy the 7-game plan?" It's like, "Yes." That's just right now.
Yeah.
I will go to more than 7 games. Don't worry, White Sox. I will go to more than 7 games. But, I mean, Chicago has that market. They're the transplants. But the transplants live in Wrigleyville. They live in Lakeview. They live in Wicker Park, Logan Square. Very close to Wrigley. It's much easier to get to Wrigley Field than it is to U.S. Cellular Field. And that's where it hurts the White Sox. So if they could draw 2 million next year and have a winning record, that would be awesome. I just don't see them drawing 2.5 million at least for a couple of years.
It would need a postseason appearance.
Maybe a couple postseason appearances.
But, you know, you mentioned TV ratings, and that's hopefully one thing we'll be talking about next time we talk is hopefully the White Sox have figured out what the broadcast booth looks like, or they're ready to announce it, because that's still up in the air. Last we heard was Bruce Levine's report that Hawk Harrelson was going to take a reduced schedule, work only road games, and that the home game broadcasts are still up in the air. And there hasn't been any further word, rumors, movement on that. So hopefully by Sox Fest, as the White Sox kind of gear up for that, that they'll have an idea of what broadcasts will look like. And between that and the scoreboards going up in the stadium, there could be some different looks for TV for, you know, fans at the stadium. And, you know, maybe they're trying to move that forward, but it would be nice to have a big signing to go along with those other things to kind of get people watching and going to the stadium for baseball reasons.
If they can increase TV ratings, especially in April and May, that would be really big for them, because when you don't, that is how you get Carry On My Wayward Son, the Miller Lite commercial, 7 to 10 times a game, because nobody wants to buy advertising for the White Sox games.
Yeah, it's a shame. That commercial was good.
It just got overplayed.
Yeah, until I saw it, you know, 5 times a night for...
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Probably saw that commercial more than 500 times.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, I'm glad that actor, he's getting paid.
Yep.
Regardless.
He did a good job.
He does. He's a very good commercial actor. Oh, man. Good stuff. Well, that wraps up as far as this episode of the Southside Sox podcast. This is our season finale. We don't have another podcast scheduled until our season opener, season 3 in 2016, will be posted on February 1st, 2016, as we recap all the events that happen at Sox Fest. And of course, entering into a new season, there will be some new things that will be happening to the podcast that we're going to be very excited to be hinting at and announcing after the new year. I'm pretty excited. One of those things is that we're moving homes. For those that listen on soundcloud.com/Southside Sox, still going to work as far as making sure that you can listen to the podcast there. But our main home is going to be moving over to Audio Boom, which Audio Boom is based in London. For our fans that are across the seas over in Europe, they host every Sky Sports podcast, every Premier League Teams podcast, and they just recently announced deals with Cumulus Radio and Yahoo Sports in the States, and they recruited us. So we are moving over to that platform. I'm very excited. They have a mobile app that you can download either in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or the Windows Store as well, making it much easier for you to listen to the Southside Sox podcast every single week. If you do have iTunes, don't worry. The podcast is still going to be there. You can easily find our show if you go to iTunes and go to the store, search Southside Sox. There you can subscribe to the podcast. And if you just discovered this show and you're listening through iTunes, if you can give us a review, we'd love to hear your feedback. And of course, you could follow us on Twitter at Southside Sox. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Southside Sox. And Jim, I guess all I got left to say is been fun, great 2015 yeah. from our perspective, maybe not so much from the teams. And if the White Sox do make a big signing, we'll have an emergency podcast. We'll do it live on Mixlr.com/Southside Sox. If you don't know, that's our live channel. We rarely do it. Only for the big stuff. So hopefully we'll have it one soon for our sake. I thought this was a great season as far as the podcast. I'm really excited. We've been working hard already going into 2016, and hopefully the White Sox give us plenty to talk about.
Yeah, and thanks for all your work, and wish you a Merry Christmas, and to our listeners, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, even though that's past. Hope you had a good one if you celebrate Hanukkah. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and yeah, January. Sox Fest, February 1st, we'll be back. So if you can do without us for a month and a half, hang in there.
Yeah. that's the White Sox motto for 2016.
Yeah.
Hang in there, guys.
Hang in there, baby. The cat on the wire.
Oh, man. Well, of course, I want to thank to everyone that participates as far as SouthsideSox.com to help make this show possible. Of course, can't forget about our partners in crime, Patrick Nolan and Adam Hazlitt. Mm-hmm. We know them as P. Knowles and Hazy, for coming in, chiming in, helping. They've been helping since day one. Of course, Larry covering the beat for the White Sox Miners for us at SouthsideSox.com. You're definitely going to want to read his work as prospect rankings will be launching later in the winter, in late January, early February. It'd be very interesting to see where Jim Callis of MLBPipeline.com, friend of the podcast, will rank White Sox prospects as well as Keith Law as well. And of course, we can't forget the founder of Kenwar, Ken Needley, for also helping out on the Southside Sox podcast. So that will do it for season two. Thank you so much to you, the fans and listeners, for listening every single week. We greatly appreciate it. It means a lot to us. As the Southside Sox podcast is a production of SouthsideSox.com, an SB Nation community site for the Chicago White Sox. For the last time in 2015, alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening.